Welcome to the Empowering Agency Workers, a podcast for all temporary workers. If you're unsure of your rights, unsure how to find work, or just plain unsure, we're here to help. It's all too easy to be exploited, so your expert host, Julia Kermode, will empower you to succeed.
Right, well, welcome to today's podcast. I'm really pleased to be joined by Luina. She is a solicitor and was previously head of legal services at the Recruitment and Employment Confederation. And she's going to talk to us today about Brexit and how that impacts on agency workers. And when she was at REC, Luina advised agencies on employment law, general commercial matters, and as well as issues specific to recruitment, such as agency workers regulations and other things such as IR35, which we've covered in other podcasts. And Luina left REC recently and is in the process of setting up as an independent consultant. So I fully support her in that, obviously. And, you know, maybe these podcasts will be of use to Luina in her own right going forward. So, welcome, Luina. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Julia. Thank you very much for asking me to do it.
No, you're really welcome. As I say, we're talking today about Brexit and the impact on workers' rights. What is changing in relation to freedom of movement, which obviously has now changed in the light of Brexit?
Hi, Julia. Yes, I mean, I think we're definitely going to have a fun-filled hour talking about workers' rights post-Brexit. And yes, the starting point is freedom of movement. Freedom of movement is one of the pillars of the European Union. We know that to be a member state, you have to allow freedom of movement of people. And of course, that grants your own citizens the right to freely move across the EU as well. But the UK is no longer an EU member and has also decided not to accept freedom of movement going forward. And so since the 1st of January 2021, freedom of movement has stopped. So that means the European nationals no longer have the same rights to freely live and work in the UK. But similarly, UK citizens don't have the same rights to live and work across the EU either. So quite a dramatic change for those of us who are under a certain age and have only ever known the European Union and have long enjoyed the freedom of movement. But so going forward, then what we've now got to think about is really the new points-based immigration system that we have in the UK. And that became effective on the 1st of January 2021. EU citizens who arrived in the UK before the 31st of December 2020, so essentially New Year's Eve, can apply to stay in the UK under the EU Settlement Scheme, also known as EUSS. The deadline for applying is actually this year. It's the 30th of June 2021, and the period between the 1st of January and the 30th of June, we'll just call that the grace period, but I will come back to that later on. Applicants to the EU Settlement Scheme will receive either a settled or a pre-settled status from the Home Office. They'll receive an email telling them of their status, but they won't get a physical document. And we know already that this has proved to be quite a problem for some individuals, because they also need that some sort of document for landlords, etc. And there's been a lot of concern that this lack of a physical document could cause another Windrush 2.0. But for the meantime, the Home Office are quite clear that they're not going to issue physical documents. They're going to have this email, and people are going to have to demonstrate online that they have either settled or pre-settled status. Now, if an individual has either of these statuses, they will be able to work in the UK, use the NHS for free if they can at the moment, study in the UK and access public funds. So more or less pretty much carry on as they currently are doing. But if you don't have those statuses, or in fact, if you're an EU citizen and you come to the UK after the 1st of January 2021, well, then you will be subject to this new points-based immigration system as any other migrant from outside of the EU has previously been. So quite a significant change for individuals going forward.
Yeah, and we'll cover the points immigration in a second, won't we?
Yeah, but there is just briefly, there is one exception to these rules for Irish citizens. Remember that there is what we call a common travel area between the UK and the Republic of Ireland. And this has existed before either state joined the EU, the EC back in 1973. And the common travel area continues to this day. And what it means is that effectively there is freedom of travel and freedom of movement between those two states. So citizens of the UK and Ireland keep the right to live and work in each state. So Irish citizens who are working and living in the UK do not have to apply to stay in the UK under the EU settlement scheme and are not subject to the points-based system. But similarly, also UK citizens can live and work in Ireland. But that's the only exception that is quite a specific carve out.
Yeah, and that's a really important point, actually, about Ireland. So I'm really glad you covered that. It's really important, and especially as that's the only exception. So what can you tell us about the points-based immigration system?
Right. There's been quite a lot of talk about this over the last few years. Now, I am not an authorised immigration lawyer. You have to be actually authorised and regulated specifically to give immigration advice. But I can certainly give you a summary of the immigration system going forward.
Right. That would be fantastic.
So I think there are two key areas to be aware of. One is the employer sponsorship licences. And then the second is the worker's visa. And I'll take each of those in turn. So looking at the employer sponsorship license, as I said earlier on, the new scheme is applied since the 1st of January 2021, and it effectively is employer managed. Before an employer can offer a job to a non-UK national, they must have a sponsorship license from the Home Office. When they get that license, they have it for 4 years, and it is then renewable, provided, of course, they continue to meet all of the compliance and reporting obligations to which that license is subject. It's important to note that we actually have had an employer's licensing scheme for a number of years. So there will be some employers who are already familiar with this. But there, right. Obviously the key change is that EU citizens are now potentially subject to this scheme, as well as other non-EU migrants who previously would have been subject to it. So once an employer has a license, they identify an individual to whom they want to give a job, they can then give a certificate of sponsorship to that employee. There is a charge for this, and employers also have to pay the immigration skills charge. And you know, these are quite significant costs to be paid up front. And you know, so significant costs attached to hiring a non-UK or a citizen, or indeed an EU citizen who doesn't have settled status. And then there are also some additional charges which the person who is applying for the worker's visa should pay, unless they can get the would-be employer to pay it for them. And they include the immigration health surcharge, which is a hefty £1,872 as we speak today in January. And that actually applies per family member. So really quite a significant upfront cost if you're planning to bring your family with you. And then there's also the overseas government fees. So this whole scheme is, you know, it's quite costly.
Yeah, that is a lot of upfront costs, isn't it, actually? And, you know, that amount per person, I guess it might potentially put people off, which I guess is part of the point of Brexit. And it's not for us to kind of get into that, really. But yeah, I'm surprised how much it is.
Yes. And again, you know, if you are accustomed to the freedom of movement, and for whatever reason, you either can't get settled or pre-settled status, or indeed you come to the UK on or after the 1st of January, you know, quite a significant a change for individuals. I should just note one thing here. When I talk about employers, I am actually talking about businesses that can offer a permanent or fixed term contract to an individual. I'm not talking about agencies here. This has been an issue for agencies for quite a few years, that they cannot get a sponsorship license to supply temps and contractors to clients. This is only available to those offering perm roles.
That's a real shame, because agencies play such a key role in recruitment, obviously, and it's a shame that they can't get the sponsorship license. But I guess that's no change, though, in effect, because they haven't had it before anyway, have they?
That's absolutely right. So If I can move on then maybe to talk about the second part of the scheme, which is all about workers' permits or visas. There are different permit routes into the UK. So, for example, we have the skilled worker visa, which effectively replaces tier two visas. We also have intra-company transfers. We have a graduate route, a seasonal worker route, and there are others as well. Interestingly, though, Julia, there isn't a self-employed route. Which we have previously had, really, you know, individuals could come to the UK if they could demonstrate that they were genuinely self-employed. But we don't seem to have that route at the moment. Now, each of these different permits and visa routes have minimum earnings thresholds and points thresholds. And so that could have quite a significant impact on some of the lower earning sectors and also those that are heavily reliant on migrant labour. And I will talk about some of those later on. I can't go into details about all these visas, one, because we don't have time, but also because I'm not an authorised immigration lawyer. But if, for example, we were to just look at the skilled worker visa, just to give kind of a heads up as to the sort of things that an applicant has to have. So if I were to apply for a skilled worker visa, first of all, the employer that I'm planning to work for must have been pre-approved by the Home Office. So they already have to have a sponsorship licence or be in the process of getting one, or certainly apply for one before they give me a job. Or formally engage me. Then the employer has to give the certificate of sponsorship to the worker. And that makes it clear that there has to be a confirmed job offer before I can apply for a visa. I can't apply for a visa on a speculative basis. The job that's on offer must be on the list of eligible occupations. And in fact, all jobs will have an occupation code. Then there has to be a minimum salary, which for the skilled workers visa is currently $25,600, unless the going rate for the particular job is actually higher, in which case then the higher rate would apply. And then I also have to have a minimum amount in the bank account to show that I can support myself and any family. And at the moment, that's £1,270. And again, you know, it might be that you could negotiate with the employer if they want to support you instead. But again, it depends really, you know, on what the employer is paying. We've already identified that quite a lot of significant upfront costs as well. So quite a costly affair.
Yeah, that's actually a really long list. I think I counted 5 points as you were going through there. So that's quite a long list to qualify to apply.
It is, but actually there's even more. The applicant also has to be able to speak, read, write and understand English. Now, the Home Office will assume prior knowledge and understanding of English if you come from one of a very limited number of countries. So, for example, Australia, the US, Canada and some of the Caribbean countries, but also Malta. Now, that's the only European Union state which they will recognise an individual as having a sufficient level of English. Remember, obviously, Irish citizens, I mentioned previously, are not subject to the points-based system anyway. So that's why they don't appear on this list. But also, if I work in a particular sector, so for example, if I'm a doctor, a dentist, a nurse or a midwife, and the relevant regulatory body have already assessed the level of competence and have assessed that you are competent in English, then those individuals also don't have to then separately prove their knowledge of English. So depends on what country you're from, very limited number of countries, or indeed if I'm in one of a limited number of healthcare professions.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense actually with the professions, if they've already kind of been tested by their regulators. So that I think is sensible.
Okay. And then once you get your visa, so that visa is given to the applicant for that specific role. So if at some point then the individual wants to move job, then they have to apply in advance to update the visa. And they certainly shouldn't start a new job until they have the updated visa. So again, it does restrict people's movement between jobs. Again, is something that you wouldn't have been previously used to if you're an EU citizen. And also, if you wanted to then take a second job, which had more than 20 paid hours work, then you would need to apply to update the visa. And one of the restrictions is that that means whilst you're waiting for your visa to be updated, you can't travel outside of the UK, Ireland, the Channel Islands or Isle of Man. So there will now be, you know, once you get the visa, there are then restrictions on how you can use that visa and how you can travel, which people really need to be very aware of when they get the visa. There are also some health and care worker visas. They are cheaper to apply for. We've identified the costs. And in those ones, the applicants don't have to pay the annual immigration health surcharge. It would be a little ironic, don't you think, if you had to pay to use the service you were actually providing yourself. But yeah. There you go.
That is actually quite positive, isn't it? That they don't have to pay the immigration health surcharge, you know. We need health workers at the moment. So
Certainly, I mean, yes, we're in very difficult times at the moment. So so as I said, Julia, earlier on, there are a number of different visas which are available. They all have their own different restrictions, points thresholds, earning thresholds, etc. So it's really essential that both the employer and the would-be employee know which visa is the most appropriate to apply for, what are the eligibility criteria for those visas, and then any restrictions that might be on the applicant using that visa.
And I kind of think the restrictions are going to be the biggest learning curve, if you like, because that seems to me to be quite a big change to what we've been used to before. So very, very important point to make sure you know exactly what visa is appropriate and what those restrictions are. So just to sum up then, how does that apply to EU citizens?
So EU citizens will only be able to live and work in the UK if they have already got pre-settled or settled status under the EU settlement scheme, or, you know, they're in the process of applying for it and get it by the end of June 2021, or if separately they have indefinite leave to remain. So if they don't have any of those statuses, then they will be treated as any other non-UK national and will have to apply to live and work in the UK under the new points-based system. So what's really important here to think about now is that it's the position that's being recruited for that's important. It's not where is the worker coming from, what citizenship do they have. Quite simply, if someone doesn't have a valid right to work in the UK, they will be deemed to be an illegal worker. And so that will be a massive shock to anyone who previously lived and worked under the freedom of movement rules.
Yeah, that is a big change. And of course, people might inadvertently find themselves to be in an illegal worker, which will be quite a surprise to them. And I just know a couple of friends of mine who are used to that freedom of movement. And, you know, I'd hate to think that they were here illegally. So I'm going to make sure they listen to this podcast, actually, to kind of make them aware of all these changes. So one thing I have heard of is frontier worker visas. What on earth are they?
Yes. So a frontier worker is someone from the European Economic Area, which comprises of the European Union states, but also then Norway, Iceland, Liechtenstein and Switzerland. And there's someone who's either self-employed or employed in the UK, but they actually live outside the UK. So if you're a frontier worker and you've been working in the UK on or before the 31st of December 2020, they can still enter the UK for work until the end of the grace period, which we previously said is the 30th of June, and they can use their valid passport or national ID card for that. But then from the 1st of July 2020, they will have to have this valid frontier worker permit, or indeed if they become a frontier worker on or after the 1st of January, then they need that permit to enter and work in the UK in the first place.
Yep, that kind of makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. Now, fortunately here, there isn't a fee for the frontier worker permit, and the permit holder won't have to pay the immigration health surcharge. I'm guessing really that it's kind of almost people who commute between countries effectively, you know, for work. But importantly, the frontier worker permit will only apply to the actual applicant themselves, and they won't be able to bring in any family members or dependents on to the UK on that permit. Unless, for example, they wanted to apply separately under the EU settlement scheme. Mm-hmm. But again, like all other permits and visas, there are criteria such as how many days the applicant can spend in the UK, but also the work that they're coming in to do must be genuine and effective. So, for example, not coming in just to do an interview or signing a contract. And then there's one other thing that I ought to mention, and these are short-term visa business trips. So if you are traveling into the UK for a business trip, you can get a short-term visa, which would be limited to a maximum of 90 days in any 180-day period, although I'm not sure I'd call 90 days short-term, but there you go. And again, there are restrictions around these. So, for example, you're coming in to do a meeting, which is fine, But there are other activities which have been specifically allowed and not allowed. And if somebody's applying for one of these visas, they really do need to look at the agreement between the EU and the UK to understand what is and isn't allowed. And then one final one, there are also what we call intra-company transfers, which again, some companies will already be familiar with, you know, particularly if they're a multinational organization, they want to con people over to another office for them to learn certain skills, etc. But these intra-company transfers will be available for managers and specialists who are employed and whose companies want to send them overseas for a period. But again, as I say, lots of restrictions around these. You really got to understand which is the right visa to apply for.
I must have sort of been asleep throughout most of this Brexit process, but I'm sort of surprised about the number of restrictions that there are. And so, yeah, completely agree. You really need to check what is applicable to your specific circumstances, don't you?
Absolutely.
Okay, so having just gone through the points-based immigration system, which is a complicated subject, so you've done well to kind of get us through that. What's changing in relation to right to work checks?
So that's a really good question. And the very straightforward answer is that nothing is changing, in the sense that employers and agencies have always had to do a right to work check on all employees or temporary workers, anybody looking for work. So the obligation to do a check has always existed and will continue to exist. But obviously the fundamental difference now is that where somebody is an EU citizen, their rights will differ depending on when they came to the UK and what status they have. And so therefore employers and agencies alike need to really understand what the rules are and what sort of documentation that they ought to be looking for. So the basic principle, therefore, is that the employer must do the right to work check. Now, as a rule, agencies don't employ temps on contracts of employment. They may do, but in the main, agencies engage temporary workers on contracts for services. And that means that they're a worker for employment rights purposes, but they're not employees. And so that can be quite important when we're looking at worker rights. But for immigration law purposes, agencies are deemed to be the employer, which means that they are then legally required to do the checks when they're supplying someone for temporary work. And if they don't do the right to work check or indeed keep the right records, then they won't have what we call the statutory defence. And they could, in fact, be fined up to £20,000 per illegal worker. So a really big sum of money here. So important for agencies to understand whether, you know, they're acting, whether they're finding a perm role for somebody, in which case it's the actual employer who will do the right to work check. Although as an agency, I still want to understand someone's status so that at least I can kind of pre-warn an employer, either you need to be able to sponsor them or whatever. Or if they're acting as an agency supplying temporary contractors or temps, then they need to do the actual and full checks themselves. Now, interestingly, of course, employers won't be required to make retrospective checks on existing employees, although many are likely to have done so already or be in the process of doing that because they don't want to find that they've been that they are potentially engaging someone who now becomes illegal. But also, and I do find this one quite odd, employers and agencies will not be required to check whether someone entered the UK before or after the 31st of December 2020, and therefore whether they're eligible to apply under the EU settlement scheme or whether, in fact, the points-based system applies to them. So I find that rather odd because I think that puts them in a bit of a pickle, to be perfectly honest with you. And in fact, actually, if they ask somebody, you know, that, you know, when they entered into the UK, that's actually unlawful under the withdrawal agreement with the EU. So I do find that really very odd. And it might well be that some just gently probe, shall we say, rather than outright ask, because it's important for everyone to just understand what someone's status is.
That's actually quite tricky for them to know what to do for the best. And I think if it was me, I would probably try and check. But you've got to be careful, haven't you?
Yes, absolutely. And then there's just one other thing I want to talk about. Depends about right to work checks. It also depends on the entity that somebody works through. So I've mentioned employers giving someone a perm job. I've mentioned agencies. But of course, Particularly if I'm a temp worker or a contractor, I may work through an umbrella company, or I might work through my own personal services company. If I work through either of those, so a traditional umbrella company that employs somebody, or my own personal services company, then I would probably be an, you know, I would be an employee. And therefore, it's the umbrella or the personal services company that does it. Now, of course, if it's my own limited company, say Luina Farr Limited, it does rather sound a bit bizarre, doesn't it, that I do a right to work check on myself. So I think, you know, but we do have to know where the legal obligation rests. But I would just say that I would absolutely expect agencies, and certainly when I was advising agencies, I always advised them to do a right to work check just for reputational reasons, because they would want to know that they weren't potentially supplying someone to a client who is illegal, even if the legal obligation didn't rest with them. They want to be sure that they're not potentially exposing their client to something as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and reputation is so important. And I think if I was a client engaging workers to a recruitment agency, I would kind of hope that they were doing checks as well, even if it's my responsibility. And I would hope that they wouldn't supply an illegal worker to me. And so thinking
But sorry to cut across you there, Julie, but you're absolutely right. But I must admit, hope isn't a word that we use as lawyers. So you're right. As a client, I would hope that. But certainly if a client expected that, then they probably ought to put that in what we call a service level agreement, or, you know, certainly there should be a contractual provision around that. So there is a difference between what's legally required and then what's contractually required and what somebody might expect. And that's, you know, why people like me are staying in business. You know, we draft the contracts to cover all these off.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I guess it's worth having that conversation with your clients if you're an agency, just to be really, really clear about what their expectations are, because you're quite right. What I might hope as a client is fruitless if I haven't communicated that, or if it's not in the contract and agreed. So thinking of agencies, will they need to carry out any additional checks? For example, will the criminal records checks and that sort of thing be affected by Brexit?
So agencies have long had to comply with certain rules about the arrangements or the contracts that they have with temps and clients. We have what we call in the trade, the Conduct of Employment Agencies and Employment Businesses Regulations 2003, very long-winded. We just call them the conduct regulations. But essentially, they set out the minimum rules that agencies have to comply with. But they also require agencies to carry out certain checks. So, for example, on ID, references when somebody's working with vulnerable people. But then there are also potentially criminal, as you mentioned, criminal records checks, DBS checks and safeguarding. And also for certain roles in the financial sector, there are some roles which require financial checks. So agencies, depending on the sectors they're in, will have some more specific checks to do. But none of those are affected by Brexit. Those rules are quite separate, and nothing is being done to affect those obligations. But just in terms of criminal records checks, I mean, it will be very interesting to see quite how these are affected because of the information that may or may not be available to police forces and the DBS going forward. I know there's been some discussion about the UK having withdrawn from various databases, etc. Now, agencies themselves wouldn't have been accessing those, but there might be a knock-on effect in terms of the information available to some of the police forces, etc. We have to wait and see. But the very simple answer to your question is agencies will still have to do all of the other checks that they have to do on candidates before they either introduce them to clients or supply them to clients.
Okay, well, that all makes sense. So it's almost kind of business as usual there. Is there anything else to think about in terms of agencies potentially bringing workers into the UK post-Brexit?
Yes, there is actually the question of professional qualifications, and this one is actually quite close to my own heart. So to support the freedom of movement in the UK, member states commit or agree to recognise qualifications achieved in each other's member state. Now, some member states have been pulled up over the years for not quite playing ball. But the general principle is that, you know, if I qualify as X in one country, those qualifications will be recognised in another EU state. So, for example, I'm Irish, but I qualified as a solicitor in the United Kingdom. And so before the UK left the EU, my UK legal qualifications would be recognised across the EU. But at the moment, there is now So going forward from a Brexit day, from the 1st of January, that mutual recognition of professional qualifications will no longer exist. And I think that's quite a serious defect in the trade and cooperation agreement that was signed between the UK and the EU on Christmas Eve. Services account for, I think, around 80% of UK GDP, but they're only covered to a very limited extent in that agreement. And this lack of a mutual recognition of professional qualifications is potentially a very big issue for people across all sectors. That said, the agreement does allow for recognition agreements to be negotiated on a profession by profession basis. So I would say in the meantime, if you're an EU national and you want to work in the UK, or indeed you're a UK national who wants to work in the EU, it's your personal responsibility, really, to make sure that your qualifications are recognised in the relevant state that you want to work in. So rather than being able to effectively passport your qualifications across the whole EU now, if you want to work across different states, potentially, you're going to have to look for recognition of your qualifications across those states. That said, again, there is a possibility for recognition agreements to be negotiated, and it remains to be seen what ones are there. But the government has said that it will provide guidance to the various regulatory authorities and professional bodies in early 2021. I don't have any more specific dates around that, but this potentially is really quite a big issue. For individuals.
It's massive, actually. And I suppose for us, we get to keep you here in the UK, Louina, but you might have other plans, but it's kind of good in that way. But that's obviously just one isolated example. And really, we're already in early 2021. Let's hope it's not too long before the government produces the guidance, because we all need clarity. It's a massive point, actually. And given how many different professions there are and the qualifications, that I didn't see that coming. I suppose I've been burying my head in the sand really about Brexit, to be honest,
I didn't see it coming either, because Julia, if it wasn't obvious before I mentioned that, I am an Irish citizen, but my qualification, I qualified here, but there has been a tradition of UK qualified solicitors moving to Ireland, or at least going on the role of the Irish Law Society, so that they can operate across the border, particularly if they work for businesses, law firms that have offices in both countries. And very suddenly, I think it was around the end of October or sometime in November, the Irish Law Society just said they were calling a halt to that.
Wow.
With immediate effect. So, again, some of us, I suppose we were slightly resting on our laurels, assuming that we'd be able to recognized very straightforwardly, but that is a significant thing. So I won't be going to Ireland for some time, because I'd have to requalify or pass some additional exams, maybe.
Well, we get to keep you, so it's good. It's good news for us. But that's massive, actually. So a bit of a shocker then for kind of the end of last year. So we've talked about quite a few different things in relation to Brexit. Will it even be possible to have temporary workers in the UK from overseas in the post-Brexit world that we're now in?
Yes, it will. It doesn't close down that part of an agency's business. But the clear thing here is that agencies will have to know what an individual status is, and therefore what right to work they have or in fact don't have in the UK. But of course, agencies have to do this without discriminating against individuals. We've long had anti-discrimination law. We have the Equality Act 2010, and there was lots of legislation before then. So agencies, when they are checking anybody's right to work, first of all, they need to check all candidates who come through their doors. Yeah. They certainly shouldn't identify or only check individuals based on their accent or their skin color or the perceived nationality or their name, and that, because that would absolutely open an agency up to claims of discrimination. This is really basic stuff. Yes, of course they can supply people from overseas, but they have to do the appropriate right to work check on every candidate who comes through the door, and they have to be able to demonstrate that that individual has a right to work in the UK. Now, it, as I said previously, it's an individual's personal responsibility to demonstrate that they've got the right to work in the UK, but agencies do need to check everybody.
Yeah.
Um, I did say, of course, that EU citizens who arrived before the 31st of December 2020 can apply for the right to stay and work in the UK under the EU settlement scheme. But anybody who arrived after that date will then be treated as any other non-UK national. And again, then will have to be sponsored by the prospective employer. As I said, also agencies cannot get sponsorship licenses. So that would limit an agency's ability to supply temps, potentially, who've come from overseas.
Yeah.
Unless they can demonstrate, you know, that they have some other right to work in the UK. But again, keep the documentation.
Yeah. Okay. And I think the discrimination point that you mentioned is really important. And I know you said it's basic, but actually we all need reminders of these basic things from time to time. So that's really, really helpful. And then I guess then the costs and process that we already talked about will then kick in once they've got someone potentially coming to work in the UK from overseas. Just thinking a little bit about the UK, and do you know if there are any particular sectors which have more EU workers than other sectors? So I'm trying to think which sectors are likely to be most affected by Brexit.
So that's actually there was quite a lot of discussion about all of this before Brexit. Mm. Of course, the EU nationals work across all industry sectors, but we do know that there are some sectors that are very heavily reliant on overseas workers. So the health and social care sector is a case in point.
Yeah.
Hospitality, of course, but also food processing, driving, interestingly enough, but also construction has quite a high level of migrant labour. And some of those sectors already have skills and worker shortages. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we know that in driving, you know, it's for many, it's not an attractive profession to work in, you know, and, you know, there are a lot of older drivers in there and a lot less younger people going into the profession. There are also costs associated with that. So there are some sectors definitely that will be affected by this more than others. And some of those sectors I've mentioned also have quite low levels of pay, close to the minimum wage in some cases. So it's actually even going to be questionable whether individuals could ever meet the earnings requirements under the new points-based system. Yeah. For some of those sectors. Now, the government has recognised that there are labour shortages, particularly in the food sector. And so there have now, previously we had SAWS, which was a seasonal, now that I've mentioned the acronym, I should remember the name, but they have effectively now kind of almost gone back to that, and they've created the seasonal worker route that I mentioned before. Mm. That is available for edible horticultural seasonal workers. And they can stay for a maximum 6 months in any 12-month period, but they can't use that to get indefinite leave to remain in the UK, and they cannot bring their dependents to the UK. Certainly, we know it's one of government's aims is to get more UK nationals working in some of these sectors. And last year, I know there was a campaign to get more British workers to work in the food processing sector. I don't think it was terribly successful, mm-hmm. But it remains to be seen. Again, you know, there's an awful lot that we have to kind of wait and see how things transpire.
Yeah, and I guess we don't really want to talk about the pandemic, but I guess the impact of that is it's causing people to unfortunately find themselves out of work. So maybe some of those people might fill some of the roles that traditionally are filled by migrant labour. And as you say, we have to wait and see how it all pans out. So do you know if there are any kind of professions or sectors which are at risk, which, you know, would be exempt from these regulations in terms of if the UK particularly wants to attract workers into any particular sectors?
So there aren't any exempt sectors. So there are no sectors which are exempted from the points-based immigration system. But the government has recognised that there are shortages in some sectors, and I've identified some of them. But there are others, and they do publish what they call the shortage occupation list. And that is regularly reviewed by the Migration Advice Committee. Mm-hmm. I checked this yesterday just to make sure that I had the up-to-date list. And so the current list as of today's date was actually published on the 1st of December. But I would encourage businesses to constantly be checking that shortage occupation list, because occupations will be added to the list, but others will be removed as well. Yeah. But for the moment, for example, I've noted that there are shortages of engineers across a range of kind of engineering disciplines, mm-hmm. but also chemists. Some IT professionals, graphic designers, and some chefs, but not for takeaways. But then there's also some separate healthcare and education lists. And occupations on those lists include psychologists, speech and language therapists, various medical professionals and STEM teachers. So if an occupation appears on one of these shortage occupation lists, then the minimum salary requirements that I mentioned previously will actually be reduced. So that is to recognise that, yes, there is a shortage in these occupations, so we'll reduce the actual salary thresholds for those individuals. Although looking at some on that list, I would imagine they would be earning well above those thresholds. So that's quite interesting anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it is positive, I guess, that there is that flexibility for occupations where there are kind of shortages of UK workers. So yeah, that's quite positive. So, and the date of the recording, by the way, for listeners, is the 9th of January, 2021. So, the list on the Migration Advice Committee at the time of recording today was last published on the 1st of December. But obviously, I guess that must probably come out regularly. I mean, I don't know how often it comes up, but certainly, as you say, Luina, it's worth people checking. Thinking in a different angle, what would be the impact on people wanting to take temporary work overseas? And, you know, we can't talk about each and every country because we'll be here forever. But broadly, what would be the impact if like I wanted to work overseas for a short period of time?
So that's still possible, but I think that there are two things that we need to think about here. The first, of course, is freedom of movement of individuals. And we've already talked at length about that. So just as a reminder, UK nationals have lost the right to freedom of movement across the EU. And similarly, EU nationals don't have an automatic right to live and work in the UK. We've already identified they either have to go through a scheme or they're subject to the points-based immigration system. But of course, interestingly, if I am an EU national, I actually keep my right of freedom of movement in the EU itself. Of course, agencies then could continue to supply EU nationals to clients in the EU. But all of this is caveated now by the other freedom, which is the freedom of provision of services. So, of course, one of the other pillars of the European Union is the single market and the freedom to provide services across the whole of the EU. This is really what the premise of the single market was all about. That if I provide services in one country, I can provide those same services in another country. Yeah. That's it in a nutshell. It was never that straightforward. You know, countries did maintain certain restrictions and limitations on some sectors, to be perfectly honest with you. It was never completely free. And this was particularly actually in the temporary placement markets. That's the terminology they use in the European Union, temporary placement services. Now, I mentioned earlier on that 80% of UK GDP is produced by services and that these are only covered to a very limited extent in the trade and cooperation agreement. At the same time, the government has chosen actively to leave the single market. It was an option to stay, but that would have meant complying with certain rules. So they've actively chosen to leave the single market. But saying all of that, the agreement does include some commitments on market access. So they do recognise the value of services across the whole of the EU and the UK. But even so, so the general principle will be going forward that neither the EU nor the UK can bar market access to service providers. So I suppose, you know, that's a good starting point. But again, there will be exceptions. And again, I mentioned here specifically placement services. So, for example, the agreement prohibits contractors being supplied to an EU client except in limited and specific circumstances. And when I was reading around this topic, I did notice that even one commentator suggested that agencies and clients might even have to move to what they call genuine statement of work contracts rather than rely on time and materials contracts. Now, of course, we'd be familiar with statement of works because we've spent a lot of time talking about IR35 as well. And I'm sure you've covered that in other podcasts, but we won't go into that one. So, you know, it does mean that agencies are going to really have to think about it's not going to be automatic that they can just kind of parachute somebody into another EU state. But even so, you know, there may be other restrictions and they may have to have a subsidiary company in the member state that they want to work in, you know. So, But these sort of restrictions have long existed. So it's not as straightforward as simply saying, you know, I'm based in the UK and I can, of course, supply somebody into the EU. They need to think about the individual status And they need to think then also about their own status and what are the local rules to the member state that they want to actually provide the services in. So they need to get very specific local advice around that.
Yeah, it is actually really quite complicated, isn't it? And, you know, you mentioned, you know, getting advice and for the individual. And one of the things of thinking about the individual workers now, there's been a lot of discussion during the Brexit negotiations about protecting worker employment rights, because of course some of our UK employment law has come from the EU. And so what are your thoughts on the impact there in terms of our employment rights here?
Yes, so this has also obviously been something that's been a massive point for lawyers and unions and workers themselves over the last few years whilst the negotiations were going on. So there are two ways that the EU really has influenced employment rights. One is through judgments of the European Court of Justice, which I'll just call it the ECJ. And this was a major negotiating point. What would the role of the ECJ be going forward? And it has been decided that tribunals, employment tribunals, will continue to apply ECJ case law in effect as of the 31st of December 2020, so the last day before the transition period terminated. But it has also been agreed that new ECJ rulings will not automatically apply in the UK. But I do think, Julia, it would be very interesting to see quite how tribunals will move going forward, because of course if the point that they're looking at is basically based on retained EU law, it's going to be very interesting to see how they manage that one, to be perfectly honest with you. The second point, of course, is that many employment rights are also set out in what we call EU directives, and directives then have to be directly implemented in each of the member states, and in the UK we've done that by regulations. So in the past, for example, all of our working time rights, our right to holiday pay and rest breaks, etc., came from the Working Time Directive, which is now in the UK in the form of the Working Time Regulations 1998. Yeah. We've also had the Agency Workers Regulations 2010, AWR. Those are rights which have emanated from EU law, but there are some others which are purely domestic. So, for example, here I'm thinking of the National Minimum Wage. So they've got nothing to do with EU law. So under the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, the UK, actually both parties have agreed not to weaken or reduce in a manner affecting trade or investment between the parties, its labour and social levels of protections below the levels in place at the end of the transition period. In a nutshell, what they're saying is we're not going to reduce standards. You know, we're going to try and keep the standards that we have. So it means that the UK does not have complete autonomy to do what it wants in relation to employment rights. Although if you read one of the government's kind of summary documents around the agreement, I think they might suggest otherwise, but I'll leave that there for the moment. Yeah. Just this week, actually, I did read one former Brexit MEP. He's already called for a rollback of employment legislation, including in particular, he specifically mentioned the agency worker regulations. So I do think this will be really quite interesting. And I do think the government could have quite a fight on its hands if it tried to roll back some of those rights, you know, some of these rights that, again, you know, we've come to enjoy for quite a long time. And, I can't see them really being willing to roll them back. You know, that what would that say about the country? But also, you know, interestingly, you know, for example, I was reading a TUC document, you know, their view on the agreement. And they've actually said that the agreement does not go far enough to protect workers' rights. Wow. So, you know, we could have now, you know, parties on opposite sides of the spectrum, you know, taking quite differing views now about what should happen employment rights. Mm-hmm. But for the moment, each of the EU and the UK have committed to maintaining the standards that they have. And of course, if either diverge too far, there is a mechanism really whereby sanctions or penalties could be applied. So, you know, potentially there is a break on this, but it really does remain to be seen. And one thing I would say, of course, we have long been waiting for some further work on employment rights. I know we worked together our respective organizations previously worked on what we call the Taylor Review. And this goes back to when Theresa May became PM. The Taylor Review reported back to government in 2018. It made 53 recommendations around employment law, regulations, etc. The government accepted 51. Now, they have already legislated on a handful. So, for example, the information document, etc. But there are more that we're waiting for. And we had been hoping they would be in place by the end of 2020.
Yes, but of course, it
has happened. You know, they've gone right down the legislative queue. I do understand from previous conversations that we may see a new employment bill before the summer of 2021. So that would be quite interesting. We're waiting for information on the regulation of umbrella companies, a new single enforcement body, and other changes as well.
Yeah, I can't believe it's been sort of three years now. Well, it will be 3 years by the time the employment bill comes out, if indeed it does come out at some point this year. And you know, it feels like a lifetime ago that we were working on this stuff. And you know, there's some really important points in that Taylor Review. So I really do hope we do see some progress. Because there's stuff really important for our listeners around, you know, working flexibly and that sort of thing. So yeah, fingers crossed we'll see some progress, and I might get you back on to talk us through it if indeed it does happen this year. Luina, thank you so much for taking on this massive task of giving us a brief overview of Brexit. It can't have been an easy job to kind of pull that stuff together into a short summary. So really, really do appreciate it. What I will do is I'll put some useful links in the notes that go with this podcast so that our listeners can be signposted to information. But really, I think the crux of it is that the regulations will differ according into your specific circumstances and the different countries and you know that whatever. So really people need to check and know what's going to work best for them for their circumstances. So massive, on behalf of Alice, is a huge thank you. I really, really do appreciate you talking us through the topic of Brexit, which hopefully will have helped people. Well, it definitely will have helped people. So massive thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I mean, you know, that was a gallop, to be perfectly honest with you. You know, it was a massive gallop through something that, you know, we've talked for an hour on something governments were negotiating on for 4 years. So
I know.
So it's really literally just covering, you know, skimming across the top. But yes, there are, I suppose if I were to summarize, because we both know I like the last word, don't I, Julia?
You have it.
It's really important for individuals to take personal responsibility to know what their status is, to make sure they get all of their paperwork and their ducks in a row. Do not leave it to the last minute. You know, if you haven't already done what you need to do, it's kind of like self-assessment, isn't it? We're all looking at the 31st of January, but we do leave it to the last weekend. Please don't leave it to the last weekend, because you need to get your stuff done with the Home Office. And then for employers and agencies alike, you've really got to understand what these new rules are. For some employers, it will be a bit more straightforward because they're already familiar with the sponsorship scheme, but they now need to remember that they're extending it, obviously, to EU nationals who don't have settled or pre-settled status. And obviously agencies as well, you know, continue to do all of the right to work checks in a non-discriminatory fashion, but understand that you may now be looking for new documents, etc. One thing actually I meant to mention, Julia, apologies. I mentioned about, you know, passports and ID cards earlier on in relation to frontier workers. But I noticed, I think it was either yesterday or the day before, a statement from the Home Office that actually, and I hope I've got this right, I should have double checked, that any EU citizens wanting to come to the UK from October, I don't know whether it's the 1st or the 31st of October, will actually need to have a valid passport. Because, of course, some EU states provide national ID cards and you can freely travel on those in the EU. But it seems that going forward, national ID cards will no longer be accepted by the Home Office or the Border Force. So at some point, EU nationals will have to get a passport, even if they have an ID card from their home state.
Okay. Well, that's a useful point, actually. So thank you once again. I'm going to pull you back in for a future podcast, if that's okay, because I really enjoyed chatting to you. So on behalf of everyone, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Julia, and good luck, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Empowering Agency Workers, hosted by Julia Kermode. information on today's discussion, please visit iwork.co.uk, where you can also join our growing community. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, then we would love you to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. We'll be back at the same time next week.